Welcome to Better Sex, where you get the information and inspiration to create and enjoy your best possible sex life. Join your host, sex therapist Jessa Zimmerman, as she brings you expert guests, helpful tips, knowledge, and strategies to improve your intimate relationships. And now, your host, Jessa Zimmerman.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Better Sex Podcast. This is Jessa. So glad you are here with me. Welcome. Thank you for taking the time. I hope that I have another interesting and helpful episode for you. Today, we're talking about what's it really take to make a sex life last, to co-create a sex life over time, over changes, right? Over a life together. What does it really take? Chelsea Wakefield is joining me to talk about this, and she's going to share things about energetic archetypes, about sex, about expectations, about love capacities, how all this sort of comes together to be a starting point for you and your partner to have conversations and to do things differently and literally co-create a relationship and a sex life that you can be excited about over and over and over again for the rest of your life. I hope you find it very helpful. And before we start the show today, it is sponsored by Intimacy with Ease. It's a method to help otherwise happy couples achieve a sex life that is easy and fun for both of them, so that you can actually just enjoy your sex life with zero stress. For more information, if you want to watch a brief little training video that's available, all of that, go to intimacywithease.com. Chelsea, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
You're welcome.
I would love to start with just a little bit of background about the nature of your work and what you're sort of passionate about helping people with.
Well, I've been a psychotherapist for about 23 years. And somewhere along the line, I became really interested in working with couples. I seem to have a little bit of a passion for it and a talent for it. And I just began to study as many kinds of couples therapy as I could get my hands on, so to speak. And inevitably, it led me to an awareness that sexuality is something that most couples struggle with at some right. time in their life. And the big questions about long-term relationships, sexuality in a long-term relationship, and what kinds of things get in our way, what can help move us forward so that we can actually have a meaningful connection over the arc of a relationship.
Yeah. So what would you say some of those elements are that really can make a relationship and a sex life thrive over time?
I think that sexuality has to actually be a priority for the couple. So sometimes when I'm talking to people, I ask them, well, why would you want to engage in, you know, co-creating a sexual relationship? What, you know, what would it bring you in your life? And many people don't have an answer to that question.
Really?
I think, well, certainly people that are the hungrier party in the relationship would say, I'm hungering for it. I feel really starved, sexually starved. But often, as you undoubtedly know, there's a high desire partner and a lower desire partner. And right. someone once said that someone who doesn't have a desire, Gina Ogden, the great sexologist, used to ask, desire for what? Desire yeah. for what? The idea that we need to co-create a sexual relationship and a connection that two people both want to participate in encompasses so many dimensions of relationship, including actually knowing oneself, defining oneself as a sexual being, being able to engage in conversations with a partner that might be somewhat anxiety promoting. And if you've got two people who are pretty conflict avoidant, you're not going to get very far.
Right.
If you've got one person who's kind of angry about their disappointments about the sex life, that's not an aphrodisiac.
Right.
To
right.
have somebody who's demanding and bullying or sulking and pouting. You know, there really needs to be a lot of personal development in each of the parties, which most people don't think about. In a lot of couples work, I find that most people come in wanting to change their partner.
Yeah, right. We're thinking nobody should have to change. This should just work, right? It either works or it doesn't work.
Yes, magically. Yeah. Magically.
Right.
And the idea that sex is a natural process, it's far from a natural process. I mean, if we were animals in the wilderness, perhaps just mating once a year, it might be a different kind of a process. And we're also living so much longer than we used to 100 years ago. I mean, many people, by the time they reached, women in particular, by the time they reached menopause, they might have died of childbirth or infectious disease. And so the idea that we need to stay together and actually have a meaningful connection till we're, you know, for heaven's sakes, 80 or something like that. You know, how do we do that?
Right.
We don't have a lot of help about that.
Right. Not a lot of modeling or precedent for how to do this as a species.
Right.
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 Yeah. Okay. So there's some personal work involved. There's priority that's involved. What else do you think couples need to co-create this dynamic sex life?
So obviously communication, but the thing about communication is most people think communication has to do with talking, like saying what I want and, yourself, and or defending myself against your seeming accusations.
Right, right.
There's so many dimensions of communication. Sometimes because I like to work with the metaphor of having an inner cast of characters, one of the most important questions that we can ask of ourselves is who in me is talking? Is it my vulnerable child? Is it my impulsive teenager or my rebel teen? Is it my demanding bully? Is it my whiny whoever? You know, like who in me is communicating? And can I get a healthy adult online that can actually communicate the dimension of my sensual self, not my thinking self, not my achieving self, not my graduate student self or my mother of four children self? How can I get in touch with the dimension of me that actually has to do with the senses and with presence and with participation and with play? How can I get in touch with that? And what does it take for me to shift states from maybe, you know, my responsible mom or my intellectual teacher self, my researcher, into that part of me that is available for a different kind of connection with my partner? And how do we find our way there together?
Okay, well, let's not have those be rhetorical questions. How does one get in touch with that self?
When I am working with people, I always want to know how successful are they at managing their anxiety, giving them tools for managing anxiety, which depending on their history can be a lot of work. If they've got a history of being mistreated or abused or abandoned, there's a lot more work to do because maybe at the beginning of the relationship when the dopamine was really pumping, which is that sparkly limerent part of the relationship when we just feel less inhibited and more of a sense of desire and I can't keep my hands off of you, that transition into the second stage of the relationship is a transition that a lot of people don't make successfully. Because that's when a lot of our early attachment stuff kicks up where we start to really need someone. And then people will go into, sometimes I call this the safe sex zone. One of them will maybe experimentally suggest something they can do together or try something and it doesn't go well. So they mark it off the list of things. Oh, I guess we can't do that.
Right, right, right.
And then the other will do something and the partner has a funny look on their face and they say, oh, I guess we can't do that. So after a while, the overlap on the Venn diagram gets smaller and smaller till it can just get to be extremely rote.
Yeah, that's what David Snarch calls the leftovers, right? We've taken everything off the table that makes you anxious or me anxious, and you're left with this little subset, which might be enough for a little while, but eventually it feels pretty contained. Yeah.
It's a great way of referencing it. And so one of the things that David Snarch talks a lot about, and the person that I trained a lot with, who's Ellen Bader of the Couples Institute, is I'm very much in favor of, I like to look at attachment, but I also like to look at the process of differentiation. How do we avoid the emotional contagion where I'm constantly taking care of you managing your inner state? And you're taking care of me managing my inner state. Now I'm managing me and you're managing you. And we're just communicating from over here. Oh, this is what's going on over here for me. This is something that I'm interested in. And you're doing the same thing, but I'm not hearing it as a demand, or I'm not hearing it as if I don't do that, I'm a failure.
Yeah.
But it becomes the beginning point in a conversation where I might then ask, well, tell me more about that. How do you see that playing out? And if I don't want to do this part of it, could we do that part of it? So we get flexible and creative. And also just kind of move into things, get out of our heads and get more into our experience. I find that so often people are so in their heads with all their considerations and all their fears and all their projections about where this is going to go. And if we do this, then what's it going to be next time? Is it going to be some escalating thing? And so I need to draw a line here so that I don't get too anxious and too threatened by where you're pushing this thing.
Yeah.
So there's so much anxiety management and so much of if getting back to the inner cast of characters, actually looking at who's in bed, what would it take for me to access that playful side of me? How do I talk to people a lot about shifting states. Mm. How do I move out of responsible mother into responsive lover or playmate? What do I do to move out of that? And so I spend a good deal of time talking to people about how they shift, what allows them to shift, or what might allow them to shift because their partner is doing some really good wooing. I like that term wooing, that people need good wooing skills.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like how do we make the shift? It's largely experiential,
mm-hmm.
right? Like you got to get in there and learn about what helps me set some things aside or shift states or access that playful or sensual side.
Yes.
And sometimes, get out of being the mom.
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes it even requires some sort of a ritual. So let's say that I've got a really harsh sexual inner critic who's always evaluating me, what Masters and Johnson used to call the spectator.
Yeah.
I might actually like walk the spectator out the door of the bedroom and say, you get to stay out here and you cannot come in, and shut the door. So I've actually got some sort of like a concretized ritual, or put all the things that I'm concerned about into a little concerns box and saying, all of you can live in here for the next hour or so, and I'll revisit you in an hour. But for now, I might even put like a little protective angel on top of that. Because for so many women, they have this superstition that if I'm not constantly thinking about the children, somehow I'm not being their protective angel.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wrote a book called In Search of Aphrodite, and it looks a lot at women's sexuality and their sexual archetypes. And sexual archetypes are more than roles. They're whole systems of energy that we inhabit that change the way that we think about things and see things, the way we move, the way we dress, what we say. They're really whole systems of energy. And in that book, I talk about four primary umbrella archetypes that women inhabit. Most of the women that I work with tend to live in the archetype of the nurturer. So, you know, I'm taking care of my partner. Sex is something that's good for the relationship. I need to find out who you want me to be. And if I don't really want to be that person, then I begin to shut myself down or retreat.
Yeah.
Or I engage, but I'm not really in my body. I'm not really here. Macy Day, who's a wonderful sexologist, talks about how sex is not so much about getting off as it is about getting here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that whole thing about being in the present moment. Other women are very stuck in the romantic, you know, and they might be thinking things like, if I have to tell you, it doesn't count.
Yeah. I've heard that. Shouldn't they just know?
Shouldn't they just have to say this? Exactly. Yeah. If you loved me, you would know.
Yeah.
So just working with people around how much information has to go back and forth between two people about how I like to be approached, how I like to be touched. What kinds of touch? Do I like to be caressed or squeezed or tickled? Or, you know, there's so many ways of touching someone, and we have so many areas of the body beyond the target zones that are wonderful places where pleasure can be experienced if a person is actually in their body.
Yeah.
So, and then if we're people who have penetrative intercourse, how do we know when it's time for that to happen? And just even things like how deep, how fast, all of those kinds of things that need to be talked about, which are very, very difficult for people to actually put words to.
Yeah. Do you want to share the other two archetypes?
The other two archetypes, which are really interesting to me, the third one would be the archetype of the mystic or the muse. If we think about women, these are these women. I mean, if you think about, for instance, someone like Grace Kelly, very cool, very aloof, very beautiful. Angelina Jolie is kind of a cross between a muse and the fourth archetype, which is the seductress. And so there are blends of these, which are almost like perfume blends. It's like your own unique sexual essence, which are little bits of this and that, which you can put together. But activating a little dash of a seductress, I think, is actually very empowering for most women to really look at, if I was actually to be a little bit about me and what I want, and to claim that and to actually move into something that is sort of bold, something that is evocative. Like, where do I find that energy? Who are my role models? How might I activate that in me as if I was this other person that I think, oh, I could never be like them? So the four archetypes, the nurturer, the romantic, the muse or the mystic, and the seductress. One of the interesting things about that archetype of the mystic is sometimes when I run into women who are yoga babes or really into tantra, they just want sex to be spiritualized. It has to be spiritualized, and we have to bow to each other, to the God in you and the God in me. And there has to be a lot of this attunement. And there's, you know, the idea that it would get instinctual, where there's any kind of pouncing or rolling and playing like a couple of lions or something like that is not really a part of that spiritualized dimension. So anytime we move too far into one of those four umbrella archetypes, we're going to have some difficulty, not only with our partners, but with ourselves.
You know, I was thinking as you were describing them that, yeah, that there's sort of things that work better about each of these and things that there are maybe traps with each one. It's not like one is better than the other, or there's, it can never be nurturing, right? It's, I guess what you're saying is if we're too far into
yes,
into just one, there's going to be trouble.
Yes. And so I'll send you a copy of my sexual essence wheel, because it okay. has sort of the bright dimensions of those four archetypals and the dark dimensions, the shadow dimensions where we get into, you know, if a woman gets to be too pleasing, she might actually become a martyr or a doormat.
Yeah. Yeah.
In other words, I'm just being who you want me to be, and I'm a little angry about it, or, you know, a little deflated.
Okay, that'd be good to share, because I bet that captures a lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in my latest book, which is The Labyrinth of Love, I have a big chapter on sexuality. I reference it back to the core of the book, which is about the six love capacities. So I can go through the six
quickly. Okay.
So the first one is commitment, which seems fairly obvious, because we commit to a person. But what most people don't think about is that we're actually committing to a process.
Yeah.
Relationships keep evolving over time. We change. If you just get together with someone based on the fact that you meet my needs, what if my needs change? What if my needs are fulfilled? Now what? So the process over the arc of a relationship and a commitment to remaining present. So many times when people get into trouble with each other, they start walling off and retreating.
Yeah.
So that's the first commitment.
Right. And so commitment is not something we do on our wedding day or once or make a decision, right? This is an ongoing living commitment to engage and stay
a commitment
present.
To a process and to staying present.
Yeah.
In order to stay present, the second love capacity is courage, because we have to be brave. And that's where we have to learn to manage our anxiety. And I actually think that courage is a spiritual capacity. It's something that we draw from the deep self. And we grow our courage by taking small risks, kind of like going to the gym. We start out with 5 pounds, and then eventually we can lift 10, then we can lift 15. And then over time, we get so courageous, we can really self-reveal and really be present to our partner self-revealing, and maybe even engage a little shadow and light and find out, oh, that's kind of scary to me, but I can hold steady, you know, and sort of be with you. And then to move into the third love capacity, which is curiosity.
Yeah.
Which would be questions like, why is that so important to you? Why is it so pleasurable and meaningful? And be curious about ourselves. You know, it's like, if I get scared, what just happened with me? What did that touch into? If I'm really upset, what's happening here in me? What are the origins of this? So in The Labyrinth of Love, which is the name of that book, it's got a whole bunch of questions about how to do personal inquiry and inquiry of your partner and really getting to know them more deeply.
Yeah.
The third is communication, which we talked about earlier. It's like, who in me is talking? What am I seeking? Am I actually listening deeply rather than just talking and telling?
Right, right. Communication is a two-way street.
It is a two-way street. And can I do perspective taking? Can I cross the bridge into your world and look out of your eyes and figure out with curiosity and courage, why is this so important to you? Why do you want it so badly? things of that sort. So
yeah,
I also find that the where of communication is very important, and the when. You know, yeah. It's kind of like if you start a serious conversation with the partners, they're heading out to work, probably not right. The best time.
Right. Or just before they're already like half asleep.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It was something that my husband and I had to work out, because he would like suddenly think of things as we were just drifting off to sleep and say, oh, I just forgot.
It's right. Like, right.
Please don't do that. I was almost asleep.
Yeah.
So the where, the how meaning that things like tone actually really matters.
Yeah.
Because it lands in our nervous system. What are the words that I'm using? Am I staying in personal responsibility and I language? Or I'm saying, you made me feel, you're irresponsible, you're selfish, you did that, which is definitely always going to evoke defensiveness.
Right.
So there's a lot of information on the chapter on communication. And then we move to something that people don't often think about in relationship, which is compassion. And people often mistake compassion for sort of giving people a free pass, but it's not. Compassion right. has to do with the fact that we're all human, and we actually really need to be self-aware and kind and responsible.
Mm-hmm.
So compassionate for ourselves and our own struggles and our own, the edge of our growth where we're not quite where we'd like to be yet. And compassion for a partner who will be also struggling with human stuff.
Right.
And right. not expecting them to be perfect people right out the gate.
Yeah.
So the last one is creativity. And that comes back to co-creating the relationship across the arc of the relationship.
Yeah.
What do we want to be experiencing together here? What kind of a sexual relationship? And what are we going to do over the arc of the relationship? What are we going to do at the age of 70 when we can't even get into our favorite sex positions anymore? You know, how are we going to relate? How are we going to talk to each other? What do we want to share? What is the experience that we want to have together? So those are the 6 love capacities, and they apply to every aspect of our relationship, including our sexuality.
Yeah. Hey, just a quick little break in the show, because I have something to offer you. If you have ever sat with your partner and you kind of run out of things to talk about that are not, you know, work, the kids, money, logistics, who's doing what, what's happening this weekend, if you are looking for a deeper way to connect, have conversations that build intimacy, that build awareness, you know, of yourself and your partner, I have daily conversation starters for you. You'll get them via text message every day, and then the two of you can have a more interesting conversation than maybe what you've been doing. All you have to do is text me the word topics to 206-309-8645, or look in the show notes. There's a link there. But text me the word topics, and you will start getting those every day. Now back to the show. How would you suggest couples, I mean, start to integrate these 6, practice these 6, start to, if they wanted a little bit of a process around them, what do you suggest?
I think the first and most important thing is self-awareness. In other words, actually doing a little bit of some traveling down memory lane into your history, discovering your formative messages that you think you might have moved far beyond. I mean, you may have attended, as one woman put it, the church of hate. That caused us to, you know, that you were encouraged to hate a number of people or to feel really badly about yourself. I remember I was working with a woman once, and she was raised in a really conservative religious environment, and she thought she had grown way beyond that. But I did a little something called voice dialogue, and I had her move over and speak from the part of her much younger self that had once been sitting in the pew with the fire and brimstone preacher. And she was amazed at what tumbled out of her mouth that was still in her psyche.
Wow.
About what it meant to be a sexual woman and what was allowed and not allowed. And the minute she was able to raise that up into her consciousness, she realized that that little fundamentalist self was still living in her inner cast of characters and blocking her in terms of her full self-expression and her full experience of being an adult, married, as in it's allowed now, sexual right. being. So yeah, this, you know, self-awareness, really looking at our history. So for example, a lot of times girls that are growing up that might be early developers, or maybe in a house where they're maybe not overtly sexually touched, but leered at by an uncle or a grandfather or a father or a stepfather. And they learned, boy, I better turn down whatever this is that is causing that person to leer at me. I better shut it off or turn it down. And then it never gets turned on again. And they're not aware that they did that in self-protection. But now that they're an adult and they know how to take care of themselves and set boundaries and be safe, they can turn that flame back up. So just becoming really self-aware about the starts and stops, the what Emily Nagoski calls the gas and the brakes in us.
Right, right.
And then sharing that with a partner. You know, it's like, this is in terms of approaching me, in terms of us engaging together, these are the kinds of things that feel really good for me. And I'd like to continue to grow and develop as a sexual being, but this is, you have to start where you are.
Yeah.
And then expand out. So then communicating with a partner and the two of you having compassion for each other and the places where you hit the limits of your tolerance, the limits of your anxiety, and then slowly expanding that together, working together as a sexual team, as a creative team that is being curious and lots of communication and compassion and creativity and having it be on a journey together, a journey of mutual growth.
Yeah. What brings people to a point of starting to address this stuff? Because, you know, I think people can get in a relationship and just sort of coast along on autopilot for quite a while, you know, and then you're talking about, oh, we're entering an arena of like real personal growth and upending some belief systems and shifting around our cast of characters and, you know, a lot going on. So what are the kinds of things that initiate this with a couple?
When couples come in to see me, they're usually in a lot of pain. You know, they're pretty distressed about the limits of what they've tried and what's not working, and they're stuck. They're really stuck. So the first thing I do with them is to create a frame that almost all of this, these problems are not going to be solved. They're going to be transcended by personal growth. Mm. That's how we're going to transcend them, by personal growth in each of you. And actually making the co-creation of a sexual relationship worth being in that both of you want to engage in. That's what's really important here. So we're going to, you know, we're going to start with some of the stuck places, and there's a little bit of untangling because you've probably gotten into some couple dynamics that are pretty entrenched. So we're going to look at those, and we're going to look at how to undo some of the entrenchment and do something different. I'm going to invite you to let your partner out of a box that you may have put them in, you know,
right.
You've set this person things like, oh, this person will never, or you're hopeless, or you're selfish, or just
you always,
you always, absolutely. And, and so to open the possibility that this person might be engaged also in a process of growth, and I need to keep updating my database and really encountering you, who you are today, not who you were last year or last week, but who are you now? And Martin Buber, who was a great philosopher in the 20th century, and I love, there's a phrase that he used to use about the I-thou encounter. Hmm. It was a beautiful phrase, and it had to do with what happens when we drop our agendas and our projections of who the other person needs to be or who I think you are, and actually really seeking to know the other person, really entering their world and encountering them in a fresh way, and maybe going into some rooms of their psyche that you've never been in before, or learning some things about their history that you didn't know, or how everything's set up over there to work in a particular way, what the origins of their current self-definition are, things of that sort. And dropping our expectations, dropping our projections, letting the person out of the box and encountering them anew. And those kinds of encounters I find, particularly in couples that have a really devitalized sexual relationship, tend to spark something pretty special.
So I'm curious, you know, we talked a little bit before we turned on the recording today about how much coronavirus, this whole lockdown quarantine experience that we've had, really highlight some of the struggles couples have always had. You know, like that's sort of how I think about it. Like couples, they come in for sex therapy, and that those dysfunctions or struggles are an opportunity to really go in and recreate from scratch. And like, we have to reinvent this thing. And I sort of feel like COVID has done the same thing with relationship dynamics in a way. Like it's really shown, it's just highlighted, you know, places that we maybe weren't functioning optimally already.
Yes. And what we were talking about earlier is that the kind of couples that I used to call, or I still do, activity mates. In other words, as long as we could go out to dinner and to a movie and go hang out with friends and go skiing and take trips here and there, we were doing fine because we were having activities that we could focus on that we were both finding enjoyable. But now that we're home and all we do is cook dinners and watch Netflix, we're not so happy with each other. We're finding that we're pretty bored and maybe we don't even really know each other.
Mm.
Or when we start to get to know each other, we get into really entangled conflicts about how I don't like the way you're thinking. And everybody is more anxious right now. They're more anxious and they're more impatient. So the necessity for us to manage ourselves and really, in my opinion, to really move into some practices of mindfulness and staying more in the present time, not catastrophizing about the future, or being self-aware that we've got so much irritability going on. People are really irritable right now. And a lot of people are depressed because life is not going the way that they wanted things to go, or they had an underlying depression to begin with.
Yeah.
That has gotten exacerbated by the fact that they can't distract themselves with, you know, lots of outside activities.
Yeah.
So I'm with you. A lot of the underlying dynamics that were already a problem in an intimate relationship get really highlighted and really exacerbated by the confinement of COVID.
Right. I also think, you know, there's more stressors now. People are, they've been financially impacted, or there's been, you know, heaven forbid, you know, deaths in their family, people are sick. I mean, there's all these stressors potentially that are up for people. And
yes.
So it seems to me that bonds are being really tested.
Bonds are tested. And also the big questions are up. There's a lot of big existential questions up, like, you know, what the heck are we doing here?
Yeah.
Why are we together? What is the meaning of life? You know, if everything is dangerous and we can't go anywhere, you know, why do I feel so empty? And then this whole thing that they're calling, what are they calling it? The great resignation or the great, it's where a lot of people aren't going back to work or they're quitting their jobs.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The other day I saw this on the door of a restaurant. Please be patient with us. We are understaffed like everywhere else. Please be nice to our servers.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, wow, this is like the environment where people are impatient. They're not getting their meals. And then the waiter comes and they yell at them and the waiter says, I quit. And
right,
they lost
right.
another server. We're not out of this yet.
Right. Right.
I mean, I just recently, you know, the whole mandates that everyone be vaccinated in order to work in certain environments are creating more stress. And yes, we all, you know, we want to be in a situation where we're shutting down the intensity and the length of this, you know, this ongoing month after month situation. But there are people who just have very strong feelings about being vaccinated. And I have people in my own family who are arguing about that, not in my house,
right,
but in my extended family where I've got a husband vaccinated, wife not vaccinated, mother vaccinated, all the kids vaccinated, except for the 26-year-old son who won't get vaccinated. And, you know, we're in this world where the fracturing and divisiveness of people is really elevated. And so calling on the dimension of courage and curiosity and communication and compassion and commitment of, even though we, you know, we view things really differently, we're not going to end the relationship. But at the same time, you know, I've had in some of those couples where one is vaccinated and one is not, they're sleeping in separate bedrooms and not interacting to keep each other safe. And, you know, it's a time when we really have to draw on much deeper resources than earlier when we had lots of activities to distract us.
Right. Good point. Where can people find you? What do you want them to know about in terms of looking you up or accessing your resources?
You can find me two different ways. I would love it if you bought my latest book, The Labyrinth of Love, which you can get through a variety of different outlets, Amazon, your local bookstore, etc. I have a website, chelseawakefield.com. If you'd like a copy of the Sexual Essence Wheels that I was talking about earlier, then email me and I'd be happy to send those to you. I also, as soon as COVID is over, I am going to be doing Labyrinth of Love workshops and another workshop that I've done for 12 years called The Luminous Woman, where we really look at a woman's archetypal profile and the potentials that can become, that can open to her in accessing new archetypal energies. So you can find out more about that. You can sign up for my mailing list to hear about, like, when are we going to be seeing everyone in person right, again?
Exactly. When can we do this?
When can we see each other? Yeah. So that would be great. I'm also at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences at UAMS. And if any clinicians are listening to this podcast, I do online trainings about my method of working in both sex therapy and relationship therapy. I'm right in the middle of an essentials of sex therapy right now, and I'll be having a program in January that I'm launching on how to apply these six love capacities in working with couples. So if you want to train with me, come find me at UAMS at the Couples Center. I'm the director of the Couples Center. And if you want to find me on a more personal level, you can look at chelseawakefield.com.
Great. Well, thank you so, so much.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Better Sex. Please visit our website, bettersexpodcast.com, for show notes and additional episodes.
And that's a wrap for today. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you are enjoying the podcast, if some of this material resonates with you and you would like to make a difference and make sure that this keeps coming out in the world once a week, ongoing, there are a couple things you could do to show your appreciation. The first would be to go to iTunes and rate and review the show. That really helps us be found by new listeners when you review the show on iTunes. You can find a link at bettersexpodcast.com/iTunes. The other thing I want to invite you to consider is becoming a Patreon. For a small monthly pledge, you get some benefits. So for $2 a month, you get advance access to every single episode. For $5 a month, you get a chapter of my upcoming new book. And for $10 a month, I host quarterly get to know you and question and answer chats over the web, and you get invited to that. I would love to have your membership in that become part of the Better Sex family. You can find a link at bettersexpodcast.com/Patreon, which is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Again, thanks for listening. I'm glad you're here. Feel free to comment, ask questions, get in touch. I'd love to hear from listeners. Thanks.